Right. Now to get down to it. I asked Peter to come speak tonight. I met Peter, I think we were just talking, maybe 4 years ago. And I was fairly new to sobriety. Smoked 2 packs a day. And my family's sort of crazy athletic and weird. And my sister was like, you can run this race with us for your birthday. And I was like, whatever. And Peter came out, and it was like a 10-mile obstacle course thing. And since then, I've become sort of addicted to running all these things. But that's where I met Peter. And Peter works a great program, good friend of my brother, and can't wait to see what he has to say. So, Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter. I'm an alcoholic. So since we're at a treatment center, I can share the rest of that. So I'm also an addict. I'm a survivor of sexual abuse, and I'm also a survivor of trauma. So very important for me to hear that when I was in treatment, that there were other men that had dealt with things like this. So that's why I'm saying it now. My sobriety date is September 28, 2005. That's 18 years, so you don't have to do the math. You're welcome. I got sober at 32, and this is going to start downhill. I was born in Alabama, and we just go downhill from there. But I moved 21 times before I got out of high school, and my parents divorced when I was 3. So my mom is on number 4, dad right now, and then my dad is on number 3. So just the stability stuff was out the window from the start. So so like I said, I was in Alabama. My mom divorced my dad, and me and my sister, we go and we follow her along. And her picker, as we say in the program, her picker was broken, or still is, I don't know. Anyway, so really dealt with a lot of trauma and abuse from the stepdads. You know, there's the spankings, and then there's the belts, and then there's the switches, and then there's the absolute beating the shit out of a 7-year-old child. So this was my upbringing. I went to 3 different first grades because after that stepdad pulled a shotgun on my mom, we were running away from him, so we moved around quite a bit to stay away from him. And you know, that was not easy moving around so much. And then she remarried, and this gentleman was in customer service for the phone company. So we moved around basically every year or a couple times a year after that, going from different areas that he needed to do customer service for the phone company. So it was just nuts moving around so much. You know, our family motto was pitch it, you know. Oh, do you don't need it? Pitch it. You know, throw our stuff in a bag and then move to the next place. Very poor. Lived in trailer parks, things like that. So I think the most poignant poor trailer park story I have is one of the trailers that we lived in. There was a hole in front of the sink, and you could see like literally the dirt below, and you had to like brush your teeth with your legs spread so you didn't fall into the ground. So that was one of the places I lived. It was awesome. So anywho, my sister, my mom, and whatever dad was there, or you know, whoever was there at the time, they were never around. So I was just left with my sister. You know, I think some very traumatic things happened to her as well, but I'm not going to share her story. But she terrorized me to extremes, stabbings, things like that, lots of very physical beatings, shoved horse shit in my mouth. Yeah, just, I mean, fantastic, fantastic stuff. So, you know, this is my childhood. It was absolutely nuts. We had step siblings come in and out of this, and always fought, and it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. I think back now to, I'm a parent now, to my children and their life, and to what I went through, and it's still to this day sharing it. It's like, oh man, I mean, I lived it, but it's still tough to talk about. And I've done a lot of work on it. So this is my existence, is bouncing around different places, different schools. And I was a very good student. I was kind of, I don't want to say top of my class or anything like that, but up there. And I'd wanted to go to college and be a marine biologist. That was sort of the, you know, kids have, they're like, oh, what do you want to do? I want to be a marine biologist because I loved science. And I still do. I love science, and that was this path I was going to take. So we move from Atlanta to up to North Georgia, and I meet this guy my sophomore year of high school, and become very close friends. And he said, oh, I'm going to join the Navy when I get out of high school. He was a year older than me. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And we had a family friend who was in the Navy. And so he was like, oh, let me take you to the recruiter, and I want to show you this video that they've got, this like recruitment video. And it was this video called Someone Special, and it was the Navy SEAL recruitment video. And it's one of those videos that you watch and you're like, you have one of two reactions as a person, and it's either, that's fucking nuts, or that looks amazing. And I was in the that was amazing camp. And I went from I want to be a marine biologist to I want to be a Navy SEAL. So now my goals have switched. I'm still doing really well in school, but this was my plan. So I have this laser focus on this. I'd always been in athletics, very fit, and that was this theme of my existence. Both of my grandfathers fought in World War II, and one of them always said athletics saved his life. And so that's something that I always continued in. And, you know, this is, you know, it's like, how do you tie in drugs and alcohol into this? You know, when I was seven, my mom had a party at her house for all the people that she worked with. And everybody thought it was cool to give a seven-year-old sips of their beer. Well, they thought they were the only ones who were doing that, but everybody did that. So I got loaded at seven and ended up throwing up. So there, that's my first drunk. You know, I drank here and there at different parties and stuff that my sister brought me to, but it was not, I don't have that story of, you know, you hear people in the rooms, they're like, oh, I had a drink and then the world opened up to me. That was not my experience. I drank and I partied and I had fun, but it wasn't anything that had locked its claws in me yet. And so I'm progressing through high school, and I'll drink at parties. I never drove while I drank. People offered me drugs and weed and all this stuff, and I always said no because I knew I was joining the Navy and I was going to have to do these lie detector tests and stuff, and I knew you needed a top secret security clearance to be in special warfare. So I was like, so I kept it pretty straight and narrow. I am sophomore year of high school. I go to my mom and stepdad, and I'm like, listen, I moved all these times, all this, and I've never complained. And I never did. And I want to stay somewhere my junior and senior of high school. Thought it was a reasonable request. They thought it was a reasonable request. They were like, yes, okay, Peter, sure. So my end of sophomore year, they're like, we're moving to Charleston. So junior year, I'm in Charleston, and access to the beach, and it's Charleston. It's an awesome place to live, and I was living there. And end of my junior year, my stepdad and mom were like, hey, we're moving to Greenville. And I said, no, you're moving to Greenville. I'm not leaving. And they emancipated me. And what did they help with? I had a roommate in an apartment, but they helped pay my rent. And because I did really well in school and I wasn't going to college, I had enough credits pretty much to graduate. So I just had to go a half day. And so I worked. I trained for the military, and I had my own apartment my senior year of high school in Charleston, South Carolina. Let your mind go. It was as wonderful as you think it was. It really was. It was awesome. I did graduate, shockingly, from high school. I was still doing all the things that I did. I got to sign myself out of high school, and because I was emancipated, and I would go surf, and it was great. So, high school, get the diploma, boom, right into boot camp. I get through boot camp, go through the technical school, I get orders to basic underwater demolition SEAL training. I am out in Coronado, and I'm carrying the boats, carrying the logs, you know, surf torture, all the stuff. We didn't have the effing YouTube back then, so it was going in blind, but you could see what all the stuff that we had to go through. And I was doing well. And about 2 months in, my knee started to bother me, and I didn't say anything, and I continue on with the training and not telling the medics or anything like that that my knee's bothering me. And I end up burning through all of the cartilage in my knee, and it was blown up like a balloon, but I wouldn't show anybody or tell anybody that this was going on because it's sort of the culture at the time was it was a kiss of death if you went to medical and were like, I'm hurt or injured with anything, because they pulled you out. You had to go, you know, it's a very team oriented training, and you had to go away from your team that you had really bonded with these other people. And I didn't want to do that. So I shut my mouth and just went through. I tripped on a rock on a timed run on the beach, and hurt myself. They took me to the hospital and x-rayed me, and they pulled, I take my pants off, they look at my leg, and they're like, what the hell is this? I mean, it was horrible. It was bad. It was really gross. So I now am 20 years old, and I am a disabled veteran. They cycled me right out of the military. And all of these dreams that I had, completely gone. And I had no idea what to do with my life. I mean, I had planned to be in the military for 20 years, and that was going to be my life. And it was just torn out of my hands. And I didn't know what to do. I called up my mom, and she's like, why don't you come back to Atlanta? They had moved back to Atlanta at the time. She goes, we'll help you get into college, and we'll, you know, you do that. And I'm like, okay, that's great. So I get home, and I'm like, all right, I guess I'll go to Georgia State, and she's like, oh, we're not going to help you with college. And I'm like, wow. You know, this is, if you're noticing a theme here. So I get some work as an electrician, and I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And at this point, one of my coworkers is like, we go on this work trip thing, and he's like, hey, I got some blow. You want to try some cocaine? And I was like, yeah, sure. I went from saying no all these years to everybody to, hell yeah, let's give it a shot. Guess what? I liked cocaine. It's good. Good stuff. So I'm bouncing around. I finally get into school, so I'm working. I'm going to school. I follow a girl down to Florida. I'm going to school down there. And then a buddy of mine from SEAL training, who had been injured as well, lived up in Manhattan, and he's like, hey man, I need, my parents are helping me open up a bar, and I need someone that I can trust to help me run it. So I am getting a zoology degree in Florida, and then I get an offer to go in the bar business in New York City. So of course I immediately go to New York City to get into the bar business. Because, you know, all these decisions were me just bouncing around. I did not have anybody helping me. I did not have, you know, parents who gave a shit guiding me in any way. So it was just literally like, oh, cool, you know, oh, pretty, this way, oh, that. It was just me bouncing around. And so I go up into, so I'm in Manhattan and I'm working in the bar business. And, you know, it was awesome. It was absolutely awesome. It's every, you know, it's, I worked very hard. I have a very good work ethic. And I was working 100-hour weeks. I was learning the industry. I was making a name for myself because people recognized. I had people that worked for me. And I learned all about the business. And with this gentleman, I opened up a club, a bar restaurant, another bar. So I'm getting this like skill set in the industry, and things are going well. And I am drinking heavily now because I am in the bar business. I have constant access to alcohol. I am now smoking weed regularly, and I hadn't had access to cocaine. I hadn't had anyone offer it to me at this point. So that changes, and I start meeting people who have that, you know, occasionally. And it's like, oh, would you like to do some blow? Would you like to try this pill? Would you like to do this? And from me saying no all the time, I'm now saying yes. So basically, I am now a garbage can of yes, of if you've got it, I'll do it. So I am working for this with my friend. That relationship deteriorates. And because of the name I was making for myself in the industry, another person reaches out to me and they're like, I'm opening up this very large bar and restaurant, and we need a general manager. And this is a 7,500 square foot space in Midtown Manhattan, and they wanted me to be the GM. And it was an extraordinary opportunity. So I take this job, and immediately I start seeing some things that were, we'll just say, some gangster shit was going on. And I was totally cool with it. You know, I am, very soon I'm laundering money. I am, we'll just say I come to find out I was working for an ethnic group of people who did illegal things. And I just shut my mouth. I was very good with numbers, so I did the numbers that they needed to do, and I did all these things. And this is now my life. I am now I'm 25. I'm the general manager of this very large bar and grill in Midtown Manhattan. I've got my own place. I'm embezzling, stealing. I'm now a full-scale criminal. I'm doing drugs, I'm drinking, and thought I was on the top of the fucking world. I really, really did. And on, I had a facade. Man, it was so good. Next thing you know, I'm buying. Here's the peak. I had a penthouse in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I mean, I could see the river. I could see the park. And it was, I'd elevated myself to this place. And I was so a shell inside. Drugs and drugs were now, I went from, we would go out and party, and if someone had coke or, you know, some other pills or something, that would be great to elevate the party. It's like, okay, well, I'm gonna have fun. And then every time we went out, I had to make sure that there was stuff, I either had stuff or there was gonna be stuff for me to enjoy myself, because the alcohol wasn't enough at that time. And then it transitioned to, I had to have it all the time, from not even the partying anymore. This is turning out, it was like Tuesday, and I needed the drugs on a Tuesday. So cocaine was the one that really put its claws in me. And I was taking all the different pills, smoking weed regularly. When I say regularly, I mean all the time. And drinking very regularly, pretty much daily. And so now I've got all of this stuff going on, and I'm running this large establishment, and a lot of people, I mean, I had 100 employees, and there were a lot of people who counted on me for their jobs and their welfare. And you know, I'm coming in at, you know, for the noon shift, completely coked out from 3 days of that. And they're like, hey, Peter, why don't you come sit in the office for a little while? You know, like, I'm sure my eyes were pointing in different directions. But this is where my life is progressing to this point. So, September, 11th, 2001 comes around, and I shockingly wasn't completely doped out, and I woke up in the morning to watch CNBC, to follow the market, and there's a plane sticking out of one of the towers in the World Trade Center, and I'm like, what the fuck is that? And then I'm standing there in front of my large screen television. It wasn't a flat screen back then. It was the big one that you had to have on the floor. And I'm standing there in front of it, and all of a sudden, on TV, I watched the second plane hit. And I dropped to my knees and immediately knew what was going on. It went from, how the fuck did this happen, to we are now under attack kind of thing. And so I immediately called my close friend who worked at the Chrysler building and was like, you've got to get out of there right now. Leave. You know, I didn't, you know, it was another famous building in Manhattan. I don't know if that was going to be next or what's going on. So my girlfriend at the time was across the street from the towers, and she got like the, I called her up. I'm like, get in a cab and go. And she's like, but I'm like, do you see a cab? Jump in it and head uptown. So get the people I love and cared about and kind of knew where they were, and we huddled together and ended up losing 4 friends that day. And one was a firefighter, one was a police officer. And that stuck with me. That was a very traumatic event for me. And it was something that I couldn't talk about as something that was personal to me. It was something that I could communicate with the group, like, you know, the people who had lived through it in Manhattan or done something like that. I could talk to them in that way, but I couldn't discuss it in a personal way, because there are people who had suffered so much worse than me. I had friends that had passed away, very close to me, but they were friends. You know, I know someone whose twin brother passed, and whose dad was a fireman who passed, all these things. So I didn't feel like I could be like, hey, I need to talk to you about this, because they had dealt with so much, I felt so much worse. And so I just dove, you know, that much more head into drugs and alcohol. So I am now, I cannot stop, you know, move forward, you know, what, 6-8 months, something like that. And I realize I'm addicted and I can't stop. So I get to a place, I call my stepmom, who I really, I admire. And she had told me stories about some of her coworkers, and they would do an Easter egg hunt, and there was drugs in each of the Easter eggs. It's like it was an adult party. And she told me a story about that, and I was like, hey, maybe she knows what I can do to stop. So I called her up, and I'm like, hey, Meg, I can't stop using drugs. I don't know what to do. And she's like, I don't know what to tell you to do. Like, I didn't know about treatment centers. I didn't know about AA. I didn't know about any of that stuff. None of that stuff had ever come across my path at all whatsoever. I'd heard of one of the bar owners who did too many drugs and they sent him away. That's literally all I had heard of anything like that. So one evening I'm high, and you know, I'm on day two of a bender, and I pull open the computer and I do a Yahoo search. How do I stop using cocaine? Like, literally, this is where, you know, once again, I'm coming up with these ideas. And this search engine, this pretty picture pops up of this spa-looking place with this, like, Frank Lloyd Wright building on a lake. And it was gorgeous. And I was like, I could get sober somewhere like that. They'll help me stop using cocaine. So it's in Oklahoma. And so I called him up and I'm like, hey, I need to check into your place. And they're like, okay, when can you make it? So, I mean, days later, I am flying from New York City to Oklahoma. And no, I've not been to Oklahoma before. I still don't know where it is on a map. And they pick me up in a van, and they take me to this building, and they take me to the basement, and they do the intake. And they had tested me, and I had all, you know, it lit up like a Christmas tree. And they're like, you need to stay down here for a while. So I'm a week in the basement of this place, and it's freaking weird. I don't know from rehab. I don't know what's weird and what's normal, but it was just very weird. It was like sitting and staring at people, and we're going around, and they're like, Peter, do you see this tree? And I'm like, yeah, I see the tree. And there's things like this. And finally, I make it upstairs, and we're walking around. There's pictures of L. Ron Hubbard everywhere. I had checked myself into a Scientology rehab. I will not disparage it, because I did. And this lady came up to me once after and was like, hey, I really got a lot out of that. And the only reason it didn't work for me is because they don't have, like, ongoing support. And I was like, oh, I need to stop being an asshole. So I was in a Scientology rehab. I immediately checked myself out and flew from Oklahoma back to New York City. And I was scared straight because it freaked me out. That place was weird. So... Yes. Oh, it was not easy to leave. But I'm very willful. So I'm scared straight, and I literally said that to somebody. And started to do therapy, one-on-one therapy. I got kicked out of that because finally the therapist was like, I kept talking about, you know, using, and she was like, Peter, are you high right now? And I was like, of course I am. And she's like, we're done. So we were done. And so I did an inpatient out, an IOP, and they told me about another rehab center. I didn't go, but I was the kind of guy that I would go meet at, you know, we would meet at IOP and then I would meet up with you and we would hang out and I would bring an eight ball to hang out with you. Like, I was that guy. It was horrible. I feel terrible about that, but just, this is where my head was. I was not sober at all, but I was trying the things. I was dipping my pinky toe in the things. So I went to another treatment center, inpatient, and, you know, basically a glorified bar manager, but I am in a CEO 8-unit, like, there were private rooms with TVs, and there was a par-3 golf course and a swimming pool in Westchester County, and, like, that's the type of rehab I felt like I needed to go to, because I was very fancy and very upscale. You know, trailer parks, bar manager, CEO rehab. So, at the end of that treatment center, it's like 3 days left to go, I get online and I order some drugs. And to meet me at home, and I already had the plan, I was gonna get my teeth pulled. I had like some extra wisdom teeth that I was gonna get pulled. So it's gonna give me the excuse for my drug, you know, the drug screening to go positive. After I ordered it, I literally sat there and I, clear as day, I remember, am I ever going to have the willpower to be able to not do this? I just felt so defeated. So yeah, I get out and I'm doing drugs again and drinking, and then they introduced me to AA. So I'm now going to AA meetings. In New York City, the AA meetings, they are, you count days. So if it's like, if you're 90 days or below, they go around counting days. They didn't do chips. So I would go to a meeting every day and I would progress. There's like, hey, I'm Peter, I'm an alcoholic, day 31. And I was counting how many meetings I was going to, not how sober I was, because I was drinking and using every day, and I was showing up to meetings and going to the bathrooms and using and coming out and sharing. People love that, by the way. And this was my recovery. So I was engaged at that time, because that's what everybody needs to do when they're on the downward spiral of drugs and alcohol, is to get engaged. So I got engaged and we split it off because, you know, we had moved the wedding date because I kept going into different treatment centers and doing all these things. And so we break up, and I had to get out of New York because New York was my problem. So I moved back to Atlanta because there's no drugs and alcohol here. I don't know if you all know, but there are. It's in the secret. So I get down here and I move into a condo by myself, and I can't get a job anywhere. I'd gone to culinary school to work in kitchens. So I went to a fancy culinary school and worked, you know, some like famous people, and I had this incredible resume. And now I'm in Atlanta, I can't find a job. And my ego is just crushed, because I don't walk into someone and somewhere and they're like, Peter, we want you to work with us, please. They're like, no, we don't have any place for you. So I finally get a job as just like entry-level line cook, well below my resume. And it's the opening of this very, very nice restaurant. And drinking, I found a weed dealer here very quickly, shockingly. And I'm drinking heavily and helping open this restaurant. And opening night comes along and I pull a no-call, no-show on opening night, which is a power play move. And unplug my phone, turn off my cell, and that's it. I'm done. I'm going to end it. And so I take a whole bottle of pills, wash it down with some tequila, and fall asleep. And son of a bitch, I wake up. And I'm barfing everywhere, and I'm like, get a pistol, stick it in my mouth. Can't figure out how to shoot myself and not make a mess. And this is like the, you know, it's, these are the crazy things that go through, you know, my head. It's like, how do I do this and not make a mess? So I, you know, find another bottle of pills, drop them down. Basically, I'm trying to kill myself for 6 days. And I keep waking back up. And this is horrible. You know, I'm in my place by myself, and this is 6 days of drinking, using, holding a gun to my head, and it was just absolute hell. And finally, my dad and stepmom hadn't heard from me, and they just had a feeling something was wrong, so they had the building super, like, basically knock on the door, and, like, they were going to break it down to see what was going on, and I answered the door, and they're like, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, yeah, I'm sick. I'm fine. So at that moment, I was beaten. Drugs and alcohol had absolutely kicked my ass. This was my body. And listen, I've got war stories that are fantastical, you know, use of drugs and alcohol that are exciting and all of that, but this is not exciting. This was just soul-crushing, empty hell. I had nobody, I had nothing. And, you know, I knew I was an addict, and I knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know what to do. And once again, brilliant choice of rehab. I chose this one off of watching The West Wing, and who's the guy, who's the president's right-hand man, what's that called? Whatever that guy is. You know, that dude? Chief of Staff. The Chief of Staff had gone to Sierra Tucson Rehab on the show. So I call up Sierra Tucson Rehab because it was another rehab that I had learned about on TV from a fake Chief of Staff. And so I fly out to Arizona, and thank God, the right choice. It was the right choice for me because they didn't just solely focus on my alcoholism and my addiction. I worked on my traumas, the abuses I went through, how to deal with them. I was open to their suggestions. This was the first time I took a suggestion, was at this place. We were having the family week. The family comes out for the week, and I was fucking flipping out that my dad was coming. And the guy's like, "Here, come sit down, Peter." And I'm like, I sit down with him, and I'm like, so like, just turn around. I'm like, he's coming, and I don't want to do it. And he's like, "Take a deep breath." And I'm like, the fuck is a deep breath going to do to me? Like, do you hear my problems? Like, all of this shit that's going on? He's like, "Peter, take a deep breath." And I'm like, "Fucking fine." And I felt better. And I was like, oh my God, if I can just get out of the way and listen to these people, I might get something. And, that was a big pivot point for me, was I started to really take suggestions, and I really started to do real work. And I tell you, I flew out there with my plan of, I'm going to learn how to stop using drugs. I still had a wine cabinet, like the wine fridge with fancy wines in it, and a liquor cabinet. I was like, I'm going to stop drinking and using drugs for a year. I'm going to be done with drugs. And then after a year, I'll slowly start incorporating alcohol back into my life. This is my plan. They, of course, showed me the error of my ways and how stupid that is. But I just wanted to share that was my plan. So I come out of Sierra Tucson, and they suggest that I go to an IOP. So I chose this one here. And I came and I completed this program. I met Sam Anders, in honor of Sam Anders, wonderful man, and went to a couple meetings that he had suggested. I was going to AA regularly. They said, you know, the suggestion, just they at Sierra Tucson, go to the IOP, start go to an AA meeting, find a sponsor, and start going to meetings. So I found a sponsor, and he suggested to do a 90 and 90. So I took the suggestion. I did 89 and 90, because you don't tell me what to do. But I was started to become of service. I was at the Nava Clubhouse, and they had a kitchen in the basement. And with my culinary background, I was like, I want to help out in the kitchens on the Thursday night dinners. And the gentleman was like, shit, you can run it. And I was like, no. Please do not put me in charge. Please let me cook. Let me just cook and help. Because I knew that if you put me in charge, it would be now Peter's Kitchen, and y'all better fucking recognize the culinary quality that you were experiencing. And so, you know, I didn't know how to talk to people. And that's my service work is where I learned how to communicate. People would walk up to me and say, oh, Peter, thank you for cooking. And I would go, you're welcome. I did not choke. Oh, of course it was good. You know, I went to culinary school. Do you know who I've worked with? Like, that's the stuff that comes in my brain. But I said, you're welcome. So, I mean, when I say I learned how to communicate with people, I'm very serious about that. And this program really just, it really opened things up for me. I went to individual therapy, one-on-one therapy, and did some very bizarre, like, therapy work over trauma. I went for a very specific reason. I wanted to work on my trauma. I didn't go, oh, I had a bad day. I just realized there's kids in here, and I've been dropping the bombs. I'm so sorry, y'all. Seriously, I apologize. I'm a little embarrassed. I've got kids. So anyway, I go to individual therapy and a group therapy that was not recovery related. And I'm doing all of these, doing this IOP, and I'm really focusing on my recovery. And I just, you know, things start to happen for me, I think, relatively quickly. I progress through the steps. And my recovery job turned into a phenomenal real job. I was the culinary school director for a cooking school, and I had just gone into, had a little store attached to it. I was just selling, like, whisks and stuff, pots and pans. And so I, you know, went from that all the way to running the whole place. And it was magnificent. I started to date after I had the steps in my life. I started to date after I had the steps in my life. Thank God I did that, because I needed every bit of this program to date, because it was very, I'll just say for me, I know it's for everybody, but you know, going on a first date is not a joyful, awesome, fun, relaxing experience, you know? So I went through quite a few of those. And, you know, and I ended up getting sick of that, going, like, I was, like, doing the online dating thing and, like, trying to force it. And I'm like, I'm done with this. It's going to happen when it happens. I go to a party with some friends and meet this couple, and they're like, I've got the perfect person for you. We got set up on a blind date, and it's now my wife. And I was stopped trying to force this situation. So I've been sober for 18 years, married for 15 years. My wife's never seen me drunk. Hell yeah. Thank you. So we meet. We have all these conversations up before we get married about whether we want children, finances, all this stuff. Things I'd never done in relationships before, communicated before we got married on this stuff. It wasn't like we got married and like, you don't want kids? What? You know, it's like we knew we both wanted children. And so we had a son, get married, have a son, and then we get in this really serious conversation about whether we're going to have a second child. And we're like on long walks, and we've got the lists out, the pros and the cons and all this stuff. And we're like, you know, we move from a condo in Buckhead and we get a house. And, you know, big enough just in case there's a second kid, you know, for the second kid. And we're like, you know what, we're going to do it. We're going to try for another kid. So we go for that second kid. Yeah. And go to the OB after she's like, I think I'm pregnant. And they're like, you're having twins. So, yeah, so we have this plan for two kids, and now we have three. And so the twin girls were born 18 months after Joshua, so we've got three kids in diapers. This is, you know, 2011, and the economy's not great, so I'm working three jobs. I'm going to AA, and we've got, you know, I'm sleeping literally like 6 hours every three nights. So SEAL training was good for something. I did a career change in recovery. I went from the culinary industry, and because we knew that we were going to be overwhelmed with diapers and babies, that I couldn't be, offered a job as an executive chef of, you know, one of the better restaurants in Atlanta. And I had, you hear that? One of the better restaurants in Atlanta. Like, I'm so awesome. I got a job offer as an executive chef and didn't take it because nights, weekends, holidays, my wife is a business owner and there was just no way that we could do it. So I went in with my wife and we started working together. We did a 6-month trial to make sure that we jived and have this phenomenal career now. We have this business together and our children. Let me tell you, AA is a part of my life. I go to meetings regularly, 2 to 3 times a week. I am a sponsor. I for basically 17 years now, I regularly take newcomers through the book, one at a time. All the bandwidth I have is to handle one at a time, because I can't remember two different fifth steps. And I want to be, you know, I want to be very present with my sponsees. I am of service in a home group. I do all these things. And I'm also a very present parent. I'm a very present husband. My sponsor showed me that being of service can be of service to my family and my community, and not just AA or the rooms. It's very important to me to understand that. Because I beat myself up really bad with this stuff. So I do all of these things, and I have these amazing children. One of them isn't so awesome, but she's all right. You know, you got the one that takes up 90% of the parenting. I've got one of those. And, you know, the girls are getting ready to turn 13. My son, he's 14. They're great. And my life, it really is wonderful. I can handle all of this, and it is all, I have all of this because of the fact that I have this program in my life and I utilize it for my everyday life. I did not come in to recovery to hide in the rooms. I didn't come to hide in a treatment center. I came to be a productive member of society. And that doesn't mean money. That meant I was a criminal. I stole. I met you and I wanted to manipulate you to make you feel a certain way or get something from you. And I didn't want to be that anymore. I wanted to pay, not want to pay taxes, but you understand what I'm saying. I wanted to do the right thing. And I do all of these things, and it is all not, it's not easy. Being honest is not easy. I'll just keep it, there's kids in there. I had a story, but I'm not going to tell it. It's inappropriate. About honesty. And I'll pivot to this one, just because I didn't know when to share with my now wife, the girl I was dating, about my recovery. She's not in the rooms. So after our third date, and we had some nice dates and dinners, and I obviously wasn't drinking, I invited her over to my place, and I cooked for her, and I said, I wanted to share with you why I don't drink. And she says to me, well, I assumed you'd tell me when you're ready. And I'm like, oh my God, what an answer. So I shared with her that I was in recovery and the things I did. And, you know, she's learned a lot about the program and about me. We'll just say that she's learned that she can ask me a question and get an honest answer. And she has also learned to be careful what questions to ask me. That's the subtleness of, like, she asked me a hardcore question once, and I shared with her the answer, and she did not like the answer. But, you know, this is my life. We're in the travel industry, and just went through a pandemic. You know, we've got a house, we've got a business, we've got employees, and I had no income for a year and a half. And that was scary, very scary. Leaned on the program hard. As soon as the meetings went to Zoom, I was zooming it out, you know, doing the thing. And this program has helped me through just everything that life has come at me, from whether it be amazing or terrible. I have been able to handle it. Nothing has come at me that this program and the people in it have not helped me through. So, am I good on time? Done. I'm gonna wrap it up, man. All right. Well, thank you all so much.
All righty. Thank you, Peter. That was great.